Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 64 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of non-fiction writer and novelist Alex Martin's interview with Carol Angier. Here, Alex speaks with Carol about commissioned non-fiction, games of identity, and how he turned to crime fiction. You can hear the first part of the interview in episode 60.
Well, I'm afraid we have to move back from your subversive, decadent side, because I want to move on to your commissioned histories. The first was of the Air Squadron, as you've told us. That was published in 2009. And then of the Royal Yacht Squadron, which you're working on now. So now, first of all, I assume that these do pay well, but that therefore the pipers call the tune, at least to some extent. That's like the dilemma of the architect or any commissioned artist. Is that what you found, and how do you cope with it?
Yeah, that's very interesting. When you say the piper calls the tune, well, an organisation that asks you to write its history is not going to be terribly pleased if you start saying, oh, it's interesting that your secretary was in a messy divorce case. I mean, what do you really have to write about that? So, you know, I don't write about those things. I write about the history of the organisation and the characters in it who are remarkable people, you know, who would be interesting to read about in any context at all. I mean, writing about the Air Squadron, I met people who'd fought in the Falklands War, flown helicopters and fast jets in that. One man flew Harriers off an aircraft carrier. He'd said, oh, you know, he was flying over Port Stanley and a cannon shell went through the cockpit of his plane, narrowly missing him. But he said, fortunately, none of the aircraft systems were damaged. And, you know, a man who is thinking of the aircraft systems rather than himself is a remarkable human being. You know, I met some real heroes like that. Then there were people who'd been pilots in the Second World War, fighter and bomber, great entrepreneurs. I mean, people who had made a fortune out of nothing, doing, you know, really good things, like running businesses that work very well and bring a lot of convenience and happiness to people. Both of them are really good organisations. They do a lot of charity work. A lot of these individuals do a lot of charitable work, and they're worth celebrating. And also, there's a great deal to be said on this, but it has made me rethink my own approach to the whole British establishment, to the military. I'd never met so many soldiers and sailors and airmen before. And I've realised often talking to these people that they're not only more educated, more widely read than I am, but they're also a great deal more courageous. I mean, these are people who have actually put their lives at risk for their country. I have enormous respect for that. It's made me grow up fast. So if they call the tune, I think they have the right to call the tune. And do they pay? Yes, yes, they do. They pay properly so that, you know, I can earn enough to live on and put something in the bank. That's great. But they'll never be bestsellers, just 1,000 copies are printed. It's a way of surviving as a writer now. A lot of our colleagues, as you know, have a very, very tough time making ends meet. You have to do something.
About your first commissioned history of the Air Squadron, how did it get commissioned in the first place?
A friend of mine is a member of the Air Squadron. He actually owns a tiger moth, and he took me up in it one cold January day to look at the floods around Oxford. And he told me that they were planning to fly to Cape Town from London in their single-engined aeroplanes, you know, across West Africa and all the rest of it, and across the Sahara. I thought, my God, this sounds like such an adventure. Maybe I should try and go with them and write a travel article about it, you know, or several articles. So I talked to them and they said, they interviewed me just to check that I wasn't going to be somebody who's going to be writing scurrilously about them. They saw that I was bona fide and so on, and they agreed to it. But then I couldn't sell the idea to any travel magazine or any newspaper at all. I just failed on that front totally. So this whole project just came to nothing. But meanwhile, I'd met the head of the air squadron, who I'd got on with very well. And he later said, well, we're thinking of doing a book. Would you be interested in that? So, you know, even though the articles never came to anything and they flew off to South Africa and without me, a book came from it.
Things happen like that quite a lot, don't they?
Yes. And I think, you know, actually what one should do is one should, if one thinks, oh, shall I do this or shan't I do it? You should do it. And then it may well have consequences beyond what you expect.
Always do it.
Yes.
Yes, that's a very good principle. About, you know, the research for it, how did you shape it into a book?
I listened to every, you know, 50 hours of interviews. I made notes, and then I kind of looked at it all and moved the bits of paper around, you know, chapter on this and on that, and eventually it just fell into place, really. It's funny, after you've been writing for a while, I'm sure you found this too, you sort of become easier with the form of things. I think it must be like being a kind of sculptor. You can see a block of stone and you can say, yeah, I think that'll make a nice portrait head, or that would do a, you know, for the body of an athlete or something like that. And you can do the same with telling stories. I think you sort of know how to do it. It's very hard to describe how you know, but it's just experience tells you.
So we come now to your newest literary venture, which is a thriller. You haven't written thrillers before, so this is a departure for you. It's a thriller set in Greece during the latest economic crisis, which makes a very vivid and very distressing background to the book. You lived there, as we have heard, from 2009 to 2012, so that was at the height of the crisis. So was seeing that, you know, how it was affecting people and so on, was that part of what made you want to write the book?
Yes, absolutely. I'd like to call it a crime novel rather than a thriller. It is a novel. It's about a crime. There's a crime at the centre of it. But it's not meant to be a thriller necessarily. There are quiet moments in it and so on. But yes, living there was quite difficult in many ways. I just kept meeting people who were in awful financial straits, salaries cut savagely or lost their jobs totally, people in terrible debt, people trying to run a business and horribly hampered by government bureaucracy. I mean, malevolent government bureaucracy. And I just found the whole situation around me tragic, actually. And I thought the way to deal with this in a narrative is to write a crime novel. Because actually I thought there's crimes against humanity going on all the time here. They're not the conventional crimes of people stealing things and using violence, although that does go on more and more there, but more a crime of people's lives being destroyed unnecessarily and stupidly, largely by very ill-thought-out state practices and obstacles. Now, on the other side, there is in Greece this wonderful joie de vivre that people have, which somehow compensates for all of that. So there is a terrible dark side, but there's also incredibly good fun being there. And people make light of things. They somehow manage to have a good time. They're very philosophical. And also, despite the fact there's very little sort of community feeling there, there are a great many wonderful people whose friendship is offered and sincerely offered and is very warm and wonderful. So it's actually difficult to say, yes, it was all bad. It certainly wasn't all bad. It was thrilling, but it was painful at the same time.
So yes, this novel, you know, very much shows us, I think, this wonderful country crippled by corruption and inefficiency. and above all by what you've just mentioned, which is a lack of a sense of civil society. Mm. So there's no trust in or loyalty to anything beyond the family. Now, Codename Xenophon, your novel, involves all of these factors, you know. Could you describe the story to us?
Well, there's a private investigator who is the hero of the book, George Zafirius, and he gets a letter one day from a man whose brother has been shot. His brother, it turns out, is a professor of ancient civilization. He was gay. He taught at a university in England. And although he caused offence with his theories about ancient Greece, because he was pointing out that this was a society based on slavery and war and paedophilia and all sorts of things which we regard as rather wicked now, you know, that it's kind of sentimentally worshipped by Greeks above all, but by other cultures too. So the man who was shot, this professor of ancient civilization, had caused ructions through his writing, but was that a reason for him to be shot? So that the whole investigation of the book is, why was this man shot and who shot him? And the detective's journey through the society on the island near Athens where the man is shot, and then in a parallel case that comes up with a government minister, he makes a sort of journey through Greek society, looking at who might have an interest in committing a crime like this. So that's it. I mean, the crime is used as a, or the investigation is used as a sort of search engine for going through society.
This is so complex, such a twisting plot. How did you go about this? Do you plan that book in advance? Did you plan the book in advance, as it were, like a military operation? Or did you work it out as you went along? How did you do it?
I certainly did plan it, yeah. I think you have to. I have a bit of an ambivalent attitude about planning books. I've done, you know, some of my children's books. I'd write a plan, and then halfway through the plan, I would find, this is tedious, I'm just going through the motions. And then you sort of have to listen to the characters that you've created and think, now, where would that character go, and shall I give him his head and stuff? And actually, going back to the General Interrupter, there's a figure in that called Colin, a kind of ghastly cousin who comes from England to stay, who doesn't pay his rail fares and is a total waste of space. But actually, the editor at Penguin said, I want more of Colin. Can you put some more of him in? I suddenly realised I've actually created a rather fine character here.
But you did plan a lot of Codename Xenophon.
Yes, I did. I mean, I don't know how you'd create such a complex plot without planning it. So I did have, you know, I have covered endless bits of paper with boxes with names in them and arrows going across. And it is like a military operation, I suppose. It's very similar to maps of battles and things. And then you get writing it, and then you start thinking, you know, as characters take on a life, they start to determine a bit of the plot themselves. So characters like, there's another detective who comes in to help, Hector Pizas. He started taking over the story quite a bit. His character developed as I was writing, much more than I was intending. So there are things like that. I mean, I think it's quite a mysterious thing that you start with a perfect battle plan, and just as in real military battles, things, you know, cannot possibly go according to plan.
So the fog of war and the fog of writing are, you know, that's quite similar.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say one thing about the police in this. I know they sound inefficient, but the fact is that they have too much work and not enough people to do it. So they are, you know, the scenes I described of policemen's offices, which are, you know, completely sort of clogged with papers, piles of papers, shelves groaning with these things. You know, these are people who are besieged. I met a very interesting policeman once in the north of Greece who said, we used to have a lovely quiet life here. There wasn't much crime in Greece. But now, he said, you have to, every night, you know, you have to decide, you have to do this sort of triage, you know, which of these crimes that have been committed am I going to go and deal with? You know, is it the old lady who's living in terror of being, she's been robbed once, she's frightened she's going to be robbed again? Is it the, you know, the Albanian guy who's been knifed? Is it the chemist shop that's been ram raided? Very, very hard for people to deal with it. And then you have the whole judicial system, which is incredibly clogged up, and you know, the whole country is living under this great bureaucratic backlog. It's very difficult for them. So I don't necessarily blame individuals or would say that the police are inefficient. I think they just have got too much to do in impossible circumstances.
Okay. The author of Codenames Xenophon is called Leo Canaris. And on the first title page, we read that he is, quote, a teacher in southern Greece. In other words, as in the decadent books, you chose to write not just under a pseudonym, but with an invented identity somewhat, you know, expanded. Why did you do it here? Did you feel, perhaps, that the book was pretty, you know, hard-hitting about the dark side of Greece and not want people there to know you wrote it? Or was there some other reason?
Yeah, the first reason I decided to put a Greek author's name to it was that I didn't want anybody to see this and say, oh, right, Englishman writing a crime novel set in Greece, what the hell does he know about Greece? It's a typical outsider's, particularly English, arrogant view of it. So I wanted to sort of claim an authenticity for it, which I think the book has, in the sense that I did live there, I speak Greek, I have, you know, a lot of Greek family, my wife is Greek, I know Greece extremely well, and, you know, if I'd had a Greek father rather than a Greek mother, I could have had a Greek name, so I just gave myself a Greek name for that reason. Not wanting to be identified as the author in Greece, maybe. I mean, Greece does have some rather fanatical people. I mean, if the book went very, very well in Greece, I wouldn't particularly like to be checking into a hotel and people recognising me. And so I've worked with famous people from time to time, and I don't think they have a very nice life. And I, you know, if it is going to be successful, I'd rather it was under another name for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And as for the teacher in southern Greece, well, I'm hoping to go back to Greece and live there, and I think of myself as a teacher just as much as a writer, so maybe Leo Canaris will be a teacher in southern Greece again before too long.
Right, when we come to the end of the interview, I'll have to say thank you, Leo.
Thank you, Leo, Medler, and
yes, Alex. Exactly. Alex, why did you decide to write the decadent books under pseudonyms, and how did you pick your, you know, Dorian Gray is quite obvious, we can guess where that comes from, but why Medlar Lucan?
Okay, why did we write pseudonyms? Well, Jerome Fletcher is a very, very good children's author. So he was a children's writer, I was a children's writer, and we thought, right, if we're going to write a decadent cookbook, and we want it to be really decadent and not just silly things like triple chocolate cake, then, you know, it's got to be naughty, and we didn't really want to be writing that decadent book under the same names as our children's books were. So we made up these pseudonyms. And when I say we made them up, they were born, these two characters were born at a dinner table in Oxford one night, you know, lots of wine flowing, and durian is a fruit that is found in the tropics. It's got a very good taste, but it smells absolutely disgusting. And he was going to be Durian Grigson, because we thought that it would be clever to put the surname of a famous cookery writer so that our books would be next to the Jane and Sophie Grigson's cookery books on the shelves. Then somebody said, they'll sue you. I don't know if they would or not. I mean, you can't just take somebody's name. So then suddenly, not Dorian Grigson, but Dorian Gray. You know, what a wonderful idea.
You know, this playing with the game of identity seems to me actually a very striking characteristic of yours as a writer. And that it kind of goes beyond practical reasons, maybe. And we chatted about this earlier, and you actually said to me, perhaps my double identity as an Englishman and a Greek is behind my adoption of disguises and parallel lives.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, I feel a double identity, and not only that, I feel constantly drawn into different possible lives. You know, 24 hours per day is not enough for me. I've got so many interests and things that I want to do, you know, and somehow I think creating a pseudonym is a way of inhabiting another life, you know, and doubling or tripling one's time on Earth.
Gosh, Alex, I think I'd like to try it.
Well, do. You just mustn't get lost out there as the other person. I did it a bit as Medlar. Did a little bit of sort of experimenting with the other identity, particularly in Vienna, where we were appearing every night in the restaurant and we were filmed on TV and so on, and people would interview us as Medlar and Durian and so on. And so we had to sort of keep up the act. It's like staying in role, you know. And I found it slightly odd, actually, because, you know, Medlar and Durian were tremendous drug users and utterly amoral and so on. And it's quite the opposite of me. I'm Jerome too. We don't take drugs. We don't like the whole drug culture and what it does to health and so on, although we're fascinated by scientific investigations of drug use. But, you know, it's a complete no-brainer. That is absolutely catastrophic in most people's lives. So, you know, when you're there and you're talking as Medlar or talking as Durian, and people say, oh, gosh, you know, it must be such fun to take lots of cocaine and all the rest of it. And then you're suddenly put on the spot and you just think, well, so you have to try and say something that is true to your real self, but true in character too. It got very complicated, I can tell you.
Very. All right, now a really final question. Mm. Are you planning a sequel to Codename Xenophon, and can you tell us anything about it?
Yeah, I am. It's going to be called Blood and Gold, and it's going to involve some archaeology and a lot of disappearance. But the idea is to do four, a sort of tetralogy or quartet. Originally, I wanted to look at four sort of pillars of Greek society: the army, the media, the church, and the family. And that remains my programme. I won't necessarily do a separate pillar in each book. It's interesting, although the idea of writing a crime novel is obviously to try and create a sort of bestseller, but at the same time, it's probably my most serious work. So it's rather nice combining those two aims.
It's going to be George Saphiris again? Is he going to remain your... Yes, he'll be your private eye. I look forward to the next George Saphiris.
So do I.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you, Carol.
That was Alex Martin in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Alex on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 64, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 65, the science writer and poet Peter Forbes talks us through a career that has always relied on the power, precision and adaptability of words, and the playwright and screenwriter Stephen Wakelam explains how to survive changing fashions in TV drama. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.